Kapitál. Mesačník, pri ktorom sa nedá relaxovať.
Hi there and welcome to another episode of Climax. Today, the topic that we are going to be talking about is ecofascism. But before we get into it, there are a couple things that I would like to say. First of them is basically an apology, which I would like to say because usually we try to produce at least one episode a month of this podcast. However, due to the pretty strict COVID measures within the country, and also the reason that the climate care uprising was happening this month, and almost all the people who take part or help organizing and producing this podcast were part of the climate care uprising, which, if you don't know what that is, try to check it out online, either search for Climate Care Uprising or By 2020 We Rise Up. This is an excellent, excellent project, which I think you should know about. Well, anyway, yeah, so again, I am really sorry for having this episode this late. But on the other hand, I have to say that I think it is an excellent episode and a very important topic to talk about, because we might see it all over the map that the radical right and the fascists are gaining strength, especially in the countries of Eastern and Central Europe. So talking about ecology and fascism and the junctures of those two, I think is something that we really need to start focusing on. And for that topic, I think we have some excellent guests today, Balša Lubarda and Hilary Moore. And each of them will get a little longer time to introduce themselves. However, Balša is an environmental sociologist who works as a doctoral fellow at the CAR, or Center for Analysis of the Radical Right. And Hilary is an anti-racist political educator, campaigner, and an author. So let's get right into it. So, in this episode, I would like to welcome Balša Lubarda, our today's guest. As I mentioned to you before, there's something we started doing during the last episode, and that is that we ask our guests to introduce themselves. So, is there anything you would like to tell us, mainly in what's the research that you work on? What are the things that you are most interested in?
Yes. First of all, thank you for having me. So my name is Balša Lubarda. I'm a doctoral student, PhD candidate at the Department of Environmental Sciences and Policy at Central European University, which used to be in Budapest, now it is in Vienna. And my research is focusing on conceptual connections between the far right and the environment. More broadly, I'm interested in environmental politics in general, in particular the connection between the radical right. In particular, the connection between environmental politics and environment as a more general term and ideologies. But I also work as a, I'm also a head of ideology research unit at the Center for Radical Right Analysis, where I look into all kinds of elements associated with the radical right. I particularly focus on what came to be known as Eastern Europe, and the Balkans as well. So I worked mostly in the V4 region, much as I, of course, dislike this Eastern conception, but it is in its own ways particular. So I mostly worked in the V4 region, Balkans and Italy. Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you very much. And let's now get into the topic. So the topic of today's episode is ecofascism. And it is sort of a part of this smaller series of different, like, let's say, environmental or ecological approaches. So in the episode before, we were talking in broad about deep ecology. And the one before, we were talking about social ecology. So my first question would be, is ecofascism something similar? So can we talk about ecofascism as sort of like an integral philosophical approach that sort of has its authors something like that?
Well, ecofascism is a term that has been increasingly popular over the years. And I would argue this is actually due to its soundbiting nature, rather than some profound conceptual depth or precision that this term has that is like a sort of an innate feature of the term. So when one mentions ecofascism, it almost immediately becomes clear that we're talking about a fringe movement or a fringe sets of ideas, which obviously, connect fascist ideology with environmental protection. Consequently, when one speaks of ecofascism, a link that immediately comes to our minds, I dare to generalize here, is the connection between the Nazi party in Germany and various aspects of environmental protection. So a very historical phenomena. And I'm talking here about Walter Dehr's proposals for organic farming, Alvin Seifert's Autobahn, which simultaneously aimed to depict the beauty of the authentic German landscapes, and so on and so forth. Of course, here is important to make a couple of reservations, and here I'm mostly referring to Peter Staudenmayer and Janet Beal's work, who are themselves representatives of social ecology, and who have equated, more or less equated, ecofascism with deep ecology, or who have signaled the problem of deep ecology as being potentially ecofascist or giving inroads to ecofascist thoughts. Just to go back very briefly to the German case, namely, Dehr and his companions genuinely cared only about blood and not about soil that much. So the idea of blood and soil is something that we also commonly associate with ecofascism. But we have to keep in mind that, as I said, the Nazis actually were concerned mostly with race, ruralism and rootedness, and not really with ecological considerations. So it is something important to keep in mind. Now, in more recent years, to move away from this historical, very specific historical case, in more recent years, or to be more specific, months, we have been witnessing these, the so-called "we are the virus" messages, which have once again shown how the fears of overpopulation and misanthropy can be vested in ecological claims and appear virtually unproblematic from a first glance. And this is exactly why I find this ideological nexus to be tricky, because it has the potential to enter the debate unnoticed. And I think the cases of deep ecology and social ecologism have also illustrated that in its own ways. However, whatever we come to understand under the term ecofascism is problematic on, I think, at least two levels. First would be that ecofascism is a fringe phenomenon. As I mentioned at the beginning, ecofascist organizations are not numerous, and they're usually short-lived, as the example of Green Line Front, which was an attempt of a transnational ecofascist organization, as that case has shown. Another problem, or let's say the beef I have with ecofascism as a concept, is more profound. It is simply conceptually misleading, I think. And this is the fundamental question. When we speak of ecofascism, when we talk about ecofascism, this excellent soundbite, do we necessarily think of fascists who also care about the environment on one hand, or environmentalists who tend to espouse fascist tendencies? If we're talking about the former, so if we're talking about fascists who are into environmental protection or any form of environmental activism, the question is that I just suggest that a much better conceptual alternative, and I suggested that the name of that alternative would be far-right ecologism, because it clearly situates this ideological nexus. Another reason is that far-right ecologism derives its ideological content not only from fascism as an ideology, and here is where the knowledge of ideologies comes in handy, but from other thin or thick-centered ideologies, such as conservatism, nationalism, and even populism. So if we're talking about the latter, if we're talking about environmentalists who have the tendency to spit out horrible ideas such as we are the virus, or one-child policy, or whatever, then it is fine to use the term ecofascism, because it actually serves more as a slur, sort of a taunt, and it is intended to be offensive, and I have no problem with that. So coming back to the relationship of ecofascism with deep ecology, I would not necessarily put an equation mark between the two. Obviously, some of the deep ecologists are known to be eco-fascists. And this is something that I can discuss later on. Why eco-fascism as an idea, or far-right ecologism, which I think is a broader and a better concept, is fundamentally problematic.
Maybe that's something that we can talk about actually right now, because you've already started and to talk about it, I feel, a little bit, and you already touched the topic. For example, in the last episode, and also the episode before that, we were talking, let's say, about the overpopulation myth. Or in the last episode, when we were talking about the deep ecology, we mentioned the name of Dave Foreman, one of the representatives of the American Earth First, who was well known for his anti-social ideas. And exactly like the one you mentioned, for example, like we are the virus. And I think he was glorifying HIV as sort of like nature's self-preservation system. And I think he was glorifying famine and stuff like that. Could we consider these tactics or these talking points, could we see them sort of as inroads, let's say, of ecofascism into mainstream ecology? And if so, what are the main ones that the ecofascists tend to use?
So your question, I think, fundamentally taps into the role of legacies within an environmental movement. Now, when we speak of environmental movement, I just find it rather surprising, perhaps even puzzling, that we still have the tendency to think of environmentalism and environmental movement as something which is more or less solidified and comprises actors that are essentially on the same page, which is definitely not true. The power of far-right ecologism is, I think, that it bears, it makes these delineations, these bordering points, these demarcations, quite clear, and it bears in its own ways the complexity of the legacy of environmental movement. And one of these complexities is undeniably the relationship between the far-right ecologism and deep ecology. Deep ecology is resting on the assumption that the diversity of life on Earth must be maintained because it has some intrinsic value. This is obviously a rather ecocentric approach. And it is actually recognized by, of course, John Dreyzek, who is one of the world's renowned, or perhaps one of the most quoted environmental theorists, who recognized ecocentrism as a form of green radicalism. And this is interesting in its own ways, I think. The conflation with ecofascism and consequently far-right ecologism is an accusation made, as I mentioned, by the proponents of social ecology. And just to make myself clear here, they're not only accused by social ecologists for being too close to fascism, but also by animal rights activists or theorists such as Peter Singer. So they're accused by animal rights activists for being too human-centered. So you see that it is very difficult for deep ecologists to find their own position in this theoretical conundrum. And the accusation, obviously, by the social ecologists is impeding the fundamental commitment to democracy through its endorsement of new age philosophies and an imperfect understanding of diversity. The fundamental problem social ecologists have with deep ecology is in lacking a social theory which would address the environmental crisis. So, obviously, the role of capitalism and the neoliberal capitalism in particular in what we are witnessing today. And that argument definitely holds to a certain extent. The vague nature of deep ecology is potentially problematic. And the fact that one of its notable proponents was Pentti Linkola, who is a Finnish eco-fascist, is telling in its own ways. But I think that this ambiguity may as well be the strength of this movement, which does not come... So I'm talking about the deep ecologist movement, not eco-fascist, not to be confused here misunderstood. So I think that the strength of this ambiguity is that that deep ecology doesn't come as an imposing know-how authority in the domain of social theory, something which, to be very frank, social ecologists are rightfully accused of, in my humble opinion. But also, if we're talking about the inroads of far-right ecologism into mainstream environmentalism, to finally answer the actual question, I obviously mentioned that, you know, We Are the Virus messages are a prime example of these inroads. We've all seen the posts on the social media. We've all seen people who are not fascists who are sharing these and who could identify with the message of We Are the Virus. And these overpopulation fears, which sometimes overwhelm some of the most vociferous, some of the most vocal Democrats who forget what they should be about and start upholding eugenicist policies. So what I also think we need to keep in mind if we want to understand the ways in which far-right ecologism could enter mainstream environmentalism are party politics. This is something that is obviously kept on the fringe when it comes to eco-fascism, because it's very difficult to find an eco-fascist party. In the V4 region, we could find some interesting examples, but what we are undeniably witnessing over the last 10 years, ever since I've started working on this subject, and it hasn't been a whole decade, to be honest, but there is a growing engagement of the far right with these issues, especially in Europe. So it has resulted in, I think this engagement has had its implications, so to speak. One is the diminishing of climate denialism. So there is an increasing acceptance of the anthropogenic climate change among the far right. Second point, what I've witnessed in my own research, are far-right parties that are setting up their environmental wings or environmental sections, green sections, however you wish to call them. And I think this is a very important finding, because it indicates that far-right parties have understood that environment and climate are important issues worth engaging with. And it's not only because environment brings votes. It definitely does. That's undeniable now. And I even think that even in the V4 region, the Balkans or wherever I conducted my research, we could see that the younger people are increasingly voting for parties because they have an elaborate ecological program. But another point here is, aside from the votes, is that these parties realize that this is an issue that they already have something to say on. And this is something that we tend to forget. There is a very profound ideological link that they can revitalize and revive. The beginnings of this connection between nationalism and the environment, or far right and the environment, dates back into 19th century. It's a very long link which has had its ups and downs. And I think what we're witnessing at this moment is undeniably an increase of you know, tapping into these ideological links. So the likelihood of far right entering green coalitions, let's speak hypothetically, may be low at this point. But I think that the fact that far right, let's go to, for instance, the Hungarian case, which I've researched, the fact that far right Jobbik has cooperated with Green LMP in Hungary on the issues related to small-scale farming, for instance, is, I think, a very telling one. And it tells us a lot about these inroads to mainstream environmentalism.
Okay. And now I would again like to talk about something that you've already touched a little bit, and that's the research that you've done on the ground. And I think you've done a lot of work right around here, actually, even in Slovakia, and a lot of it happening in the countries of V4. So mostly I would be interested in what you can tell us about what you've done in Slovakia. And then maybe if you have some interesting stories from Poland, Czech Republic, also Hungary, if you wanna, and then maybe even farther.
So when it comes to Slovakia, first things first, right? When it comes to Slovakia, I spent some time in that beautiful country and conducted a few interviews with representatives of Kotleba's party, Ľudová strana naše Slovensko. And what I could see was very interesting on so many levels, because that party is undeniably, in terms of the ideological spectrum, and I appreciate that they, my own respondents wouldn't situate them as radical right or extreme right, but they do belong in terms of some, if there is such a thing as an ideological assessment, then they do belong to the extreme right. And they're a very interesting example of a party which uses environment to tap into the ideological connection of Slovakians, ethnic Slovakians, of course, in their own conception with nature. And through in doing that, I heard some very interesting stories, in particular related to the role of forests in constructing a national identity. And one interesting example was, for instance, a story where, for instance, the deforestation is being recognized as a very as an existing problem, not necessarily increasing, but deforestation is a problem in Slovakia. Illegal lodging and illegal activities of that kind. And what was interesting is that the culprits, according to Kotlebists, could be pinpointed fairly easily, and they would fall into two categories. One would be obviously the international corporations or companies associated with the government. That is the first culprit. So the oligarchic type of outsiders, which is very common in right-wing populism. And the second level were the so-called unprivileged outsiders, in particular the Roma. And they would integrate this issue into the gypsy problem, as they call it. So the problem of, you know, Roma communities lodging, obviously, for firewood is something that they perceived as a threat to national identity. And I think it is such framings not only can be, of course, dangerous in its own ways, but it can be very influential, because I could see when I spoke to people who obviously don't necessarily belong to this political side in Slovakia, I could see how they could identify with such reasoning. And maybe that is one of the stories which shows how this can be related to our presence, how this framing issue can be very problematic, and it can actually influence people who are not necessarily belonging to the far right. So there's so many interesting types of framings. I mean, so many interesting encounters. I spent quite a lot of time talking to Kotlebists, for instance, about their own ecological activism. And while that ecological activism would usually boil down to, you know, collecting rubbish from the forest or picking up trash or making sure that, you know, after a concert or whatever, they're organizing an event, there's no rubbish. There were also some of these substantial attempts to engage, for instance, with organic farming or small-scale farming, because that idea means that you're going back to the land, you're having your own plot of land, and that is usually the plot of land which you inherited from your ancestors. So there's this, you know, historical link, something which is a necessity in far-right politics, that there is this, you know, historical blood ethnic type of connection between human beings and the land, the blood and soil type of connection. And organic farming is obviously, you know, for farming to be organic, it's not a necessity. So they could endorse small-scale farming, which is conventional, but they could just find it as an interesting way to introduce, you know, the green aspects of politics into their program. And this is something which I noticed also in other countries where I conducted my research. Now, of course, the field work in itself, as your listeners may perhaps, you know, they can come to a conclusion on their own. But the research in itself was super interesting, and you know, the personal encounters with these people, with people who I'm with whom I fundamentally disagree with, or that I could say I couldn't disagree more with, these encounters were very interesting, especially because I was coming from an institution which was also recognized as somewhat of an outsider, not only coming from a university, from academia, but from a university which has a very clear open society mission, and it's recognized, you know, as being founded by George Soros. So these interactions were also telling in so many ways and telling me a lot about how environmentalism in itself and environmental politics in itself can be messy. And perhaps this is one thing that we should all take away from these types of encounters with the people that you wouldn't normally do in you know, on a daily basis, I assume.
Okay, I believe there's plenty of extremely interesting stories that came out of your research. Unfortunately, as I'm looking at the timer right now, we've already filled in the half an hour that we had reserved. So from my part, that would be all, I guess. Is there anything else you would like to add as sort of like the last word?
Yes, very briefly. I was talking too long, obviously, as I always do. I want to just answer the so what question, you know, why this matters. Because far-right ecologism may not seem so relevant or dominant in today's times. But not only because of the increasing engagement of the far-right. I don't think that it only matters because of this. It matters because we are seeing more and more climate change acceptance. By the same token, this relationship, I think, problematizes the relationship between democracy and environmentalism. So we should basically ask ourselves, are we ready to work with fascists or with the far-right or however you wish to call them, you know, whichever conceptual demarcation you tap into. Are we willing to work with these people if we're talking about very specific, concrete environmental problems? Are we willing to be on the same side with them? Because the question of environmentalism, unlike the question of democracy, is not necessarily about procedures, but rather about substantive outcomes, as James Wong has actually noted once. And I think this is why environmentalism and environmental politics have always been incorporated through extra institutional measures. Quite often, the care for the environment is perceived as something non-ideological, as something that is not related to any position on the ideological spectrum, which allows for all kinds of fundamentally, again, I'm using this word too often, fundamentally problematic. But I think this is fundamentally problematic because we have so many problematic solutions to arise as valid and legitimate. You know, green gentrification and environmental racism are quite often occurring behind these pro-green policies. The polluter pays principle, which doesn't take into account the structural injustices of the society we live in. The daringly Promethean belief in technocracy, you know, technology will solve everything and, you know, the expert type of people will solve all these problems. Overpopulation fears, we are the virus and so on and so forth. These are all the types of messages which are environmentalist, but we have to question them and we have to sort of be attentive to these, because it is exactly what far right has recognized and what they're sort of battling against in their own activism. And yeah, that is the very final point I wanted to make.
I think it's an excellent point. And to be honest, I couldn't agree more. And to be honest, we already have a couple of the ideas that you mentioned in our scope, and we want to address them critically in the future. So I think we have a lot of good ideas actually from this interview as well. So thank you very much for accepting our invitation for today.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. So our next guest is Hilary Moore, who has kindly accepted our invitation to the podcast. And the first question that I basically wanted to ask you is maybe if you could introduce yourself to our listeners.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. My name is Hilary Moore. I am from the US. I think what's useful to know is have been part of climate justice struggles in the States since around 2008, mostly around direct action campaigns, pressuring oil companies and oil refineries, and a little bit of mountaintop removal work. And in those climate campaigns, just realizing over and over again how our inability to deal with race and capitalism was undermining our work. So then I shifted a lot more into anti-racist political education, and that really led me to become more of a person that writes about the lessons in campaigns, in movements, in different places since I moved to Berlin, Germany, a couple years ago. And so asking these questions of like what gets in the way of our climate movements being really broad and successful. And some of those pieces also then led me to the booklet, Burning Earth, Changing Europe, which is really oriented towards climate activists and those who are carrying forward like climate campaigns, talking about what parts of this work can really get murky or cloudy, what narratives get used often by far right or right wing groups, and where are the places that often come up throughout time that make us less successful, that keep us kind of in the same spinning around getting more people out around climate and climate justice. So that's a little bit about the booklet, Burning Earth, Changing Europe. I think the other title that is connected to it is How the Racist Right Exploits the Climate Crisis and What We Can Do About It.
Okay. You actually already touched an extremely interesting topic and something that I would like to cover in one of the future episodes. Mainly because I know this is a topic that's discussed a lot in the States, but actually not that much in Europe, and especially not in the eastern part of Europe, and that's how race is connected to ecological problems. Because people here, like the communities around here, are quite homogeneous, and so we don't really even very often like think about people of different races. And so it's totally lacking in the narrative around here. Would you be able to talk about this a little bit? Because I really think that this is going to be something new for a lot of people.
Absolutely. And what you just spoke to makes a lot of sense, right? It really depends on geography. It depends on history. It depends on context. So we should not expect one narrative to fit all of our, you know, justice struggles. So it really makes a lot of sense what you're talking about. And how I understand it, and especially from a U.S. context, you know, there's a climate movement, which is tends to be more about like nonprofits and numbers and saving animals. And then there's a justice movement, which is more concerned with people, labor, lives, and economies that are extractive capitalism. And over the years, of course, these, you know, overlap and change and influence each other, absolutely, but very much kind of think about climate justice as a people's movement and not just for quote unquote nature. And I think what is useful about some things you can pull from it is like who gets hurt first, worst, and longest when it comes to climate change, where the impact's coming down. And I think an important piece too, and we all have different historical contexts for this, is like how we got here. Usually we can understand that in terms of, you know, colonialism, occupation, war. You know, wars are usually about resources and control. And those are same of the ideologies, those are same of the worldviews that we can, I think, regardless of where you live, you know, connect to in terms of like what's the worldview and the world order that got us in this situation that no longer serves, you know, emancipatory politics, liberation, more choice, more freedom for more people, more inclusion. So there's, of course, lots of ways to come to it. But when I think of justice or when I think of climate justice, it's very much, you know, who has been impacted first, worst, and longest by the systems of extraction, whether that's colonialism, capitalism, patriarchy, all the things get wrapped up in there.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, there's one really interesting thought that Balsha mentioned at the end of our part of the interview. And that was that very often there is a narrative, like dominant narrative around that environmentalism and ecology should be or are like non-ideological, that they are nowhere and should be nowhere on the political spectrum. So is this something that you would agree with, or do you think that the tactics that will in the end save like the environment and will be able to save the living conditions on the earth should be innately political?
I mean, it's definitely an interesting point and something to be explored. So for sure. I, at least from my standpoint, I don't know how useful or relevant it is in like campaigns in the real world where people are making demands and trying to shift power. I don't know if we can call for an apolitical ecology movement. And in fact, there have been previous moments, even in Germany, where, you know, I think it's the Green Party, when it was beginning, had the phrase, neither left nor right, just forward, or something along those lines. And so, like, an apolitical environment, ecology, climate, whatever you want to call it, has been attempted before. And I haven't done the research to know how successful that was or wasn't. But I do know that we live in a political world, and the degree of effort you would need to try to contain environment in a politically neutral space, I think isn't really grounded in so much reality, at least in how I understand it. But I think what Balsa is pointing to raises some really important pieces around, I mean, there is a fear or there is a concern, right, about how uncomfortable it is that right-wing tendencies can come close to progressive and left environmental, climate, ecology movements. And I think that fear is justified and is worth paying attention to. But I think the more interesting piece, rather than stripping environment of politics, would be to understand that, right-wing impulses and even some fascist expressions have always been a part of the movement ecosystem, right? So environment, climate, ecology, it's always been a part of what we are contending with, the political ground that we're covering. And there are some movements who do have genuine concerns for the environment, you know, right-wing movements. So it is a historical phenomenon. We can see that this moment with more right-wing groups taking up climate issues as like a culmination of previous moments. Of course, some groups actually care about the environment and some groups just use the environment to, you know, usher in some terrible shit, racist shit, xenophobic shit, anti-Semitic shit. But I think what's important in the exploration, I think is more interesting, is exploring like why are these overlaps and why does it get messy? And I think it has to do with the genuine question of like something is wrong with our natural world and something ought to be done. So clearly we have different values and methods of where that leads us. But I think writing off right-wing groups who are engaging in climate and environment, that's not a strategic move. Trying to make environment, climate, ecology politically neutral, I don't know how realistic that is. What I think is useful is giving the skills, trainings, you know, refining our campaigns to be as clear as possible around what we mean when we say climate and what kind of social vision, what kind of world we mean when we talk about like an ecologically sound world. You know, it doesn't exclude humans. It's not against humans. And in fact, the people who have been extracted from for a very long time might have some good knowledge about, you know, another world being possible.
Mm-hmm. What I would be really interested in, and I know this is a really big question, but would you be able to give me at least a glimpse of an idea of what the vision is in your eyes? Like what the better world could look like? And maybe what tactics can we employ to at least to get as close to it as possible in nowadays situation?
Totally. Super big question, super important question. So I feel like, you know, you asked me, we should have another podcast where I ask you, where we ask the groups that we're part of over and over and over again, because there is no one answer, right? Like it's highly collaborative and it evolves over time, all this stuff. And, you know, I was politically kind of brought up around the Institute for Social Ecology. So I tend to see human potential as something worth organizing around. And what I mean by that is like not believing that humans are the thing that's wrong with the world, but rather there's plenty of examples where we make the world better. And that usually comes through experimentation, a lack of dominance and hierarchy, and like exploration, like in terms of creativity, right? A human creativity. And What that might look like concretely is local governments and local control over renewable energy and kind of decentralizing systems of power, which is not a new idea at all. I also think that really developing a different value system in how we relate to each other and treat each other. And I think it absolutely has to do with how we, especially in Western societies or countries, have really accepted and kind of, you know, expand this idea of punishment and obedience and control, and the ways that that just sucks not only the creative life from us, but also limits the political possibilities. So where there are experiments in other kinds of economies or other kinds of, just a set of social relationships, like how people treat each other, like that gets punished. People get locked up, right? And that gets really minimized. And so finding, like, carving out enough political space where we can practice the kinds of values that we actually want to be living into, I think that's, you know, it might seem rather maximum vision. It might seem like rather huge right now, but, you know, in the span of any person who is trying to use their lifetime to bring about a better world, you know, it's those little experiments that keep us going, those strong relationships that we develop in our context, in connecting with people in other contexts. That's what keeps us going. And, you know, we also have to think beyond our own lifetime and beyond our own generation. I think that's always been hard for humans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And another thing that comes to my mind is that you mentioned like experiments of other economies. Would you be able to give us some examples of such experiments around the world, if any come to your mind? So something that we could maybe draw an inspiration from.
I mean, what comes to mind immediately is not anything, you know, in a vacuum or outside of capitalism as we know it. For all of us who have only grown up in capitalism, you know, our imaginations are rather limited. What I think of in particular are moments of disaster, you know, moments of particular crises, whether that's, you know, human-made ecological crises like hurricanes or other things like earthquakes, or just even during COVID, right? Like, we know that the first impulse in humans is to help each other, is to find ways to support each other and mutual aid and getting people basic resources, right? Like, I heard countless stories when COVID first hit of people organizing food for elderly neighbors, of people who need electricity, right, for breathing, or just folks who need electricity for access reasons to live. You know, organizing generators so that they can still plug into whatever machine that they need. And all of that is beyond the current state, right? The current state in, I don't care what fucking country you're in, was not able to meet those basic needs and was not, and most often didn't care to, especially in my country, to meet those basic needs. So people fill in the gap and take care of each other. And it happened after Katrina. It happens multiple time and time again. People first want to support each other. And if there's ways that we can take lessons from, you know, whether it's bartering or just, you know, being glad to support each other, like that is a human impulse that we can practice and that we can grow. And what if economies were based on that ethic? I wish I had more concrete examples for you, but I don't.
Oh, yeah, no, that was really, really beautiful. Maybe because of the time restraints, maybe the very last question that I would have is, I don't know how much do you keep up with the current situation in the States, but what's happening, at least from what's being presented around here, is that basically in some parts, it looks almost like a civil war. And that's, of course, terrible, but at the same time, sometimes these crisis situations, as you just mentioned, can give us like a spark of hope in producing solidarity amongst people. I saw, for example, that in Portland, I think there was like an autonomous zone set up in a city park or something like that. So is there anything that we that you would like to mention, what we might be missing, something positive that's happening in the States right now? Because it seems pretty gloomy from here.
Yeah, your perspective is accurate. It is, I mean, in it's multiple things at the same time, and of course it's gloomy. I'm also part of an organization called Showing Up for Racial Justice, which we have chapters across the country, almost 200 of people who are trying to, or who are mobilizing on campaigns that fight racism and organize white people against racism, you know, in their small towns or big cities and everything in between. And a big part of what we're up to right now is supporting the movement for Black Lives, the demand to defund the police. And then another big campaign we're doing right now is election defense. So making it possible for people to vote, because that window is getting more and more difficult, especially for people who are might be scared to go to the polls because there's white men with guns walking around the polls trying to intimidate people, or, you know, limiting the places where you can drop off ballots. So everything in between. I think what is important to know about the States in a very summed up piece is what we're seeing right now is backlash to the gains of liberation movements. So Black folks, Indigenous folks, people of color movements have been making big, big political gains in recent years. And I would say that everything that is happening, including Trump's first election, you know, to these armed right militias, you know, planning to kidnap the governor in Minnesota, like everything in between, or Michigan, everything in between is a backlash. And what we know about backlash is that it can get quite brutal and violent. And what we know in those kinds of contexts is that we really need each other. And so I think what we're seeing right now is carrying forward that mutual aid ethic in taking care of each other and then working with people who we don't typically work with, which is not the same as giving up your politics, but you're trying to broaden out your base. And I think that that's very important. So it's less of, you know, a few individuals taking big action and more of like, how do we move together even if we don't have the exact same politics? So there's a broad base of people mobilizing to defend the election, and not because we think electoral politics are gonna bring us liberation, but because we know it's a big opportunity, like you said, right? The crisis around our election and what's happening, more people are gonna be mobilized, and we want them in long-term movements. And I think that's the thing, right? Like, we need to be really compelling. If there's anybody on the fence of like Biden or Trump, or even like, you know, racism or not racism or whatever it is, like, we want to be really compelling in our movements and our campaigns. And I think that's why we have to get better at naming what we mean by justice. And that includes climate justice. So not using terms and like ideas around overpopulation, understanding how environmental protection and an environmental conservation really quickly turns right, and understanding how if we make situational alliances, right, if we like do local campaigns where we join up with far right groups to like forward an environmental issue, that that creates a lot of political ambiguity that gets us in hot water later.
Okay, I think we are up on our time, but I think it was really amazing, and I would really love to talk to you more. Unfortunately, we will have to end here. But thank you so much again for accepting the invitation, and it was really, really inspiring and interesting to talk to you.
Yeah, no, thank you. Thanks for reaching out. I'm really glad that this podcast exists, and I hope you all keep doing what you're up to. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. See you soon.
Bye.
Goodbye. So thanks again to both of our guests today, Hilary and Balsha, and naturally to all the people without whose help I wouldn't be able to make these podcasts, and of course to all the people listening to us. Thank you again, and see you or hear you soon.
Počúvali ste Capitalx, podcast angažovaného mesačníka Kapitál, ktorého vznik podporila Rosa Luxemburg Stiftung zo zastúpení v Českej republike a Fond na podporu umenia. Viac článkov nájdete na webovej stránke www.kapital-noviny.sk, kde nás môžete podporiť napríklad objednaním predplatného. Za čo vám vopred ďakujeme.